This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, getting ready for my holidays. I'm off next week, but don't worry, Luke Jones is going to be in the hot seat looking after you. Nice episode to end the week on, though. Coming up, just fascinating interview with Andrew Marr. He's been a journalist now for 40 years. Many of those stalking the corridors of power, and he's got a great new book out called The Elizabethans, which is all about the age we are living through now. So that's a great interview with Andrew Marr coming up. But first, let's have our columnist panel today with Melanie Reid from The Times and The Daily Mail's John Stevens. Now, I want to talk about the fact that we appear to be now guinea pigs. It wasn't bad enough that we're trying to work out what's going on with coronavirus in England. It turns out that we are being watched around the world, other countries waiting to see what we should do, what they should do based on what's happening here. US State Department issuing its highest level warning against Britain on Monday, urging people not to travel. The Delta variant is the reason to blame. Before I speak to you, John, in fact, Melanie, you're in Scotland, so to some extent you are one of the people looking at us as guinea pigs. How is it being viewed in Scotland?
Well, with a certain sense of detachment, I think. But, you know, it's always nice not to be the person carrying or to be the canary in the coal mine, isn't it? I think there's a touch of sitting. It's like at school where you sit back and you dare the city boys to go and do something, just to see whether they'll get away with it or not. And there is that sense of ooh, let's see what's going to happen. And I personally would love to know what Professors Whitty and Valance are muttering in darkened rooms.
John, what is your sense of what Whitty and Valance are muttering in darkened rooms, and whether or not the government is particularly comfortable being the world's guinea pig?
I don't think the government wants to be the world's guinea pig, to be honest. But I think we'd have to kind of have a bit of caution that even though it was branded as the Big Freedom Day, if you actually go around, you know, on the trains, on the tubes, I was surprised how many people are still wearing masks. Obviously, it seems like the world and its wife are having to isolate at home. So I'm not quite sure it's the big bang opening that was expected. And I'm sure the pictures of people clubbing in GAY at midnight on Monday morning have gone around the world. But whether actually you've got loads and loads of people going out, going crazy, enjoying the freedom, I'm not quite so sure.
And actually, I mean, particularly on the American thing, partly because it's done by state mostly, rather than, you know, edict from the White House. But I mean, large parts of America have no restrictions. You know, stay at home orders have been lifted. You know, retail's opening up. You don't need to wear masks. And that's happening right across the. So I'm not entirely sure that that England is necessarily completely out on a limb here. In terms of how are people in Scotland itching to have their freedom, Melanie, or quite happy to let others go first?
I get the impression the Scots are pretty cautious. I think there is a lot more sort of canniness up here, a lot more wariness. There's just not the same gung-ho thing going on. I mean, I don't even think we've got as many flights leaving the country on holiday and things. Nicola Sturgeon has always played she's always preferred to let the English make the mistake first, I think. Maybe she's right, maybe she's wrong, but it's a very tough one. I personally, it worries me slightly because I kind of feel that the politics, it's slightly Brexity. It's that sort of Britain's a world leader. You know, it's gone to our heads a bit. It's all a bit Boris-y. It's all a bit Boris-y, isn't it? It's all kind of a bit rash chaps.
Although it is interesting that the Nicola Sturgeon approach has basically been to tut at anything Boris Johnson does and then basically do the same thing a couple of weeks later with much the same result, it has to be said. Yeah. Sorry, John, I cut you off.
Well, no, that was exactly the point I was going to make, that Nicola Sturgeon's done quite well at painting herself as being much more cautious than gung-ho Boris. But as you say, she's basically done the same things but a week or so later with a different name. So they look slightly different, but they've basically been the same.
It's politics, isn't it?
It's
actually quite funny. It really is quite funny watching the Scottish Nationalists sort of fencing with Westminster over COVID.
And actually, on the politics, John, we've seen a little bit of now. I think there was a Servation poll this week which saw the Tory lead over Labour had narrowed quite a bit. I think there were others showing similar trends. Do you think that the public might be starting to think that this is a mistake? Although, you know, our focus group that we had earlier this week showed that although the polls show everyone loves the restrictions, speak to them in a focus group, and nobody seems to be following them at all, including my favourite, the woman who has got the app, but she turns it off when she leaves the house and then turns it back on when she gets home again. Do you think, you know, the wobble with the self-isolation pilot and all that at the weekend, should Boris Johnson be worried about the politics of all this?
Well, it has been quite confusing what the message has been. So, you know, saying we're going to get rid of the legal restrictions on masks and then advising people to wear masks and saying, oh, nightclubs can open, anyone can just turn up, and then saying, oh, but in September, you'll have to be jabbed to go. That I'm not sure that gives the impression quite of the government knowing exactly what they're going to do. But on the other side, I mean, Labour haven't really set out a clear position of what they would do differently, which I think is slightly difficult for them. So on vaccine passports, they say that they're broadly against them. But I think when it came down to a vote, or if it does come down to one in the autumn, they probably will back it if there's an option to get tested instead of having a vaccine. And I think, you know, Keir Starmer's, you know, struggling with setting out a different vision of what he could do differently has meant that, you know, I'm not sure there's masses of people turning away from the government and turning towards Labour.
Yeah, no, I thought what was striking was Keir Starmer had better theatre at PMQs on Wednesday, mainly because he just kept laughing at all his own jokes. But actually, his position seemed to be, you told us it was Freedom Day. It's not Freedom Day at all. Why are you unlocking? Why aren't you unlocking? You know, we want... take off your mask, put your mask on, and people shouldn't be, it's terrible all these people isolating. Why aren't more people isolating? Why aren't we locking down? Why aren't we opening up? And I suppose that's partly what oppositions can do, but I suppose it's good theatre in PMQs, but maybe it doesn't make much impact. Well, we'll see if there are polls coming out over the weekend too. Now, I want to talk to you because in about an hour's time, the opening ceremony of the long-awaited 2020 Olympics starts. It's all going to be a bit somber, you know, one solitary torch possibly, and not many other people. Melanie, are you excited about the Olympics and Paralympics?
I wish I could be. And you know, I feel the opening ceremonies, they're always so weird and puzzling and over the top and hard to watch. I find always, do you not always find them faintly embarrassing? And this is going to be even worse because there's going to be nobody watching. It's this sort of pointless extravaganza, and there isn't even going to be a few thousand people there clapping politely. I think it rather symbolises the misery for quite a lot of the you know, these fantastic, beautiful young athletes who've worked so hard, and they're going to be performing in emptiness.
But I mean, when we've spoken to some of them on the show the last few weeks, they're the sensible ones, it seems, have sort of got themselves in a mindset of it's not a question of spectators or no spectators, it's Olympics or no Olympics. And, you know, Olympics with no spectators is the best that they could do. And they've been training for it for a long time and they just want to get out and do it. John, have you got your Olympics wall chart ready to go?
I haven't, but it's, you know, after practicing through... the Euros, at trying to understand a sport I don't really understand, but being very enthusiastic about it. I am ready to kind of take on enthusiasm for random sports over the next few weeks. But I mean, I totally disagree with Melanie. I think as soon as the sports start, people will forget all the weirdness. Once we get used to watching sports with no one clapping, I think it will become quite normal. And if you're an athlete and you win a gold, I think you'll be quite happy that you've won a gold. I don't think you'll really care whether it's a Corona Games or not.
And that's, I mean, when sort of football matches and rugby matches and things earlier in the year when they had no crowds and they put the fake crowd noise on, you soon sort of get in the swing of it. And you, even though you know it's fake, you just, you know, you can still enjoy it.
Matt, when have you ever competed in the Olympics? How do you know that?
Well, how rude. How rude. No, I meant for, as a viewer. I meant as a spectator, not necessarily for the athletes, but as a viewer at home, we'll still get in the swing of it, won't we? Is it all a bit like, I mean, obviously it's on a far worse scale with coronavirus, but at this point before London 2012, it was all about how the army were being called in, G4S was a mess, the village wasn't finished, it's all going to be a disaster, and Danny Boyle comes along, the amazing opening ceremony, and suddenly it was going to be an absolute triumph, and we loved it.
Yeah. Yes, from the spectator's point of view, but I just keep thinking about some of these athletes. I mean, it's fine for the sailors, who you know, they don't have to be the sailors or the cross-country horse riders. They don't give a damn whether there's any people watching them or not. But I mean, for the ones who, the glory sports, the track and field, the marathon, you know, there's none of that kind of aura of to lift them up and help them perform, and there's no celebrating or hugging or any of the kind of extracurricular activity that you get in the athletes' villages. I mean, it's all banned. They're all going to be little islands of beauty walking around, these beautiful bodies with, I don't know. We can enjoy it, but I feel sorry. I feel that they will, in later years, I'm sorry to say, I fear they'll feel a bit cheated.
Yeah. And just because, obviously, Melly, you write your column every week in the Times magazine about your disability. How do you feel about the Paralympics? And, I mean, I think actually maybe it was a thing that happened in 2012. It did get sort of almost parity in terms of the amount of public interest in it. And, you know, everybody, we end up having a discussion about disability once every four, in this case, 5 years.
It was extraordinary. And that is also when the Channel 4 programme started, the you know, what is it, the last leg or whatever, I was at the opening ceremony of the Paralympics, and you know, it was wonderful. They were sort of tossing, NHS walking sticks up in the air, and it was surreal to the point of it was bizarrely wonderful, and it was a very, very vivid event, and of course it's never been so since. But I think it did help in the long run. I think it did certainly tweak the dial on attitudes to physical disability in Britain.
Well, yeah, that's good. I think you're right. And the fact that Channel 4, the last leg has kept going ever since, and they're going to give it the full works again this time. And I also wonder, I don't know what you think, John, the fact that Channel 4 show the Paralympics means that they really do give it some value. It's not an afterthought coming after the Olympics. You know, they really do it properly.
I would definitely agree. If it was on the BBC, you'd imagine it would be shunted off BBC One and on some random channel that you struggled to find on your box. So obviously, they've got a lot of pride in it because that's their only taste of the Olympics.
Well, let's focus on the positive. It's all going to be fine, Melanie. We'll all cheer them on.
Yeah, we will.
Get your rattles out. Lovely stuff. John Stevens and Melanie Reed. And of course, you can read Melanie's column in the Times every Saturday. In the Times magazine, you can also read my column in the Times on a Saturday too. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next is my interview with Andrew Marr.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Andrew Marr has been a fixture on British television. Well, he's been a political journalist for some 40 years. First started working as for the Scotsman back in the early 1980s. Then he became a political journalist working through The Economist, where he, then political editor of The Independent, editor, columnist for The Observer. Then he moved to broadcast, where, of course, he was political editor of the BBC. Then in 2005, he filled the hard-to-fill shoes of David Frost, started presenting his own Sunday morning political show, which, of course, is still running today, and sees him interviews top politicians. Well, he's asking them the questions. Whether or not the answer is another question altogether. But alongside all of that, annoyingly talented, he's also a prolific writer, several books on the history of Britain. His latest, The Elizabethans, is out now in paper, and he's a painter and everything else besides. And also, just a lovely man. He joins me now. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, Matt. And what can I say after that? I also write symphonies and string quartets.
Now, I've got a confession to make, Andrew, because I can see your face most days because on my desk at home, never very far from me, is a copy of your book. We will talk about the Elizabethans, but it's a copy of your book, My Trade, which I first read, I think it must be 16 years ago, when I was about to start working in the press gallery in Westminster. I had no idea what I was doing, and I think it hadn't long come out in paperback, so it was sort of seemed serendipitous that it was basically a guy. It was a history of political journalism. It was both your history in journalism, but also a history of political journalism, and just how much the press gallery had changed, but also hadn't really. And it's a weird institution, isn't it? The press gallery, lobby journalists, they're a weird bunch in a weird institution, which despite everything else in the outside world, doesn't change very much.
It doesn't change very much, and it's really weird. You're quite right. It's got a very, very rigid kind of class hierarchy of lobby journalists and non-lobby journalists, correspondents and parliamentary correspondents, where I started off literally just sitting in the press gallery for sometimes 12, 14 hours a day doing shorthand notes. Because when I started, the Scotsman had a huge broadsheet page, maybe sometimes two broadsheet pages of parliamentary reports. And every Scottish MP who said anything in the chamber of the House of Commons or in the select committees or any other committees, however banal, would expect it to be reported in the Scotsman the next day. And you got into a huge amount of trouble if it wasn't there or if it was inaccurate. So I just spent days and days and days and days and days perfecting my shorthand, scribbling away these speeches. And then you were desperate to get, as it were, your ticket.
What was your word count? Because I got 100 words, and actually I did exactly the same thing. Although we were allowed tape recorders, you were encouraged when I was away for the Press Association to get it all down in shorthand. What was your top speed?
Probably about 130, something like that, T-line, which is quite fast for a T-line, 130, 140, that kind of thing. It's very often the same words, of course, it helps.
Yes, exactly. You could literally just get shortcuts for the same stuff that politicians come out with all the time. The thing that struck me, because I was thumbing back through your book, and you were basically chronicling that people like you and I, who spent time writing down everything the MPs said in the Commons, that those roles just disappeared. The newspapers stopped running columns and columns and columns of what was happening in the House, in the Commons chamber itself, because we were more interested in the lobby journalism, the gossip, the cabinet rows, the ministerial announcements, all that sort of thing. And I just wondered, actually, as I was thinking about it, in the 10, 15 years since I first read your book, has social media changed that, do you think? Social media clips of pretty unknown MPs in the House of Commons chamber now go viral. We've seen it in Dawn Butler just overnight, in a way that they probably would never have done before. And I just wonder, do you think there aren't many, but one of the upsides of social media might be that more people see a bit more of what actually goes on in the chamber?
I think the social media side is actually really useful in that. You get lots of clips. I mean, somebody like Dawn Butler accusing the Prime Minister of lying and being kicked out for refusing to apologise for that or withdraw her words. That would always have been a big story, I think. But, you know, the quirky things, some of the funny maiden speeches, that kind of thing, are beginning to appear on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and so on. That's really, really good, because I always worried that when journalists stopped reporting actually what was said in detail in the House of Commons, democracy was kind of undermined a bit. And, you know, we're talking on Times Radio, and the pivotal decision was actually taken by a former editor of the Times, Simon Jenkins. I think he was the first person to say the Times is no longer going to carry a kind of gavel-to-gavel, word-by-word, paragraph-by-paragraph account of British politics in that old-fashioned way. And at the time, everybody breathed a sigh of relief, except possibly the more obscure MPs.
Yeah, because they didn't have to carry it so much. I suppose that the downside of the social media thing is we see it particularly at PMQs, that quite often it's basically just been used as a platform to deliver a soundbite. It's not really, the quality of debate hasn't necessarily risen. It's PMQs in particular is often now just people filming their own social media clips entirely independently of the other person. You know, so Keir Starmer's looking for his clip, Boris Johnson's looking for his, and there's not very much interaction or attempt to really engage or answer the questions.
Matt, you know, there's obviously always been grandstanding going on in the House of Commons, but I think what's quite disturbing
surely not.
is the extent to which people simply talk across the issue. I mean, earlier on, you mentioned my Sunday morning show and the difficulty of getting people to answer questions. But if you look at Prime Minister's questions and the times in which, as it were, Keir Starmer asks Boris Johnson something and Boris Johnson then says exactly what he wanted to say in the first place, the clip for the evening news, whatever it might be, they talk across each other. It isn't really a conversation where somebody puts a proposition and somebody else responds to it with another fact or whatever. Or a lot of the time it isn't like that. And you slightly wonder, what is the point?
I was going to ask you about that, because obviously it's 60 years of Prime Minister's questions was marked this week. And we created the very first PMQs on the show last Friday. And the astonishing thing with that was it wasn't very exciting, but Harold Macmillan did sort of attempt to engage in the question, albeit not necessarily giving people the answers that they wanted. Or are we just, is it always the case that politicians have been reluctant to do that?
Well, I mean, it's very easy to think that the things are uniquely bad at the moment. But I remember, because I, as you so kindly and rightly pointed out early on, I was very, very old. I mean, I can remember Neil Kinnock asking Margaret Thatcher perfectly reasonable, if sort of aggressively ideological questions, Prime Minister question, I mean, being simply swatted aside as she went on one of her speeches about the evils of socialism and the Honourable Gentleman's many failures and so on. So it's always gone on. And I can remember Tony Blair coming in and again treating backbench Tory MPs with something pretty close to disdain as they tried to pin him down on the various ups and downs of that government. So it has always happened. But I say again, you know, if there isn't some kind of obligation felt by ministers to respond to the actual question, then quite quickly people turn off entirely and the whole thing becomes pointless. If when X asks Minister Y, did you or did you not authorise this, and simply gets a reply about the state of the weather and how well the English football team has done, then the whole thing becomes utterly farcical and pointless.
I wonder what impact you think the past 18 months has had, because to some extent, a lot of the counts we're talking about, I mean, certainly aside from PMQs, but sort of cabinet ministers, junior ministers, backbenchers, you and I are the oddities in that we would follow them closely and noticed if they were at the dispatch box and didn't answer, or, you know, on a quiet Sunday, you know, whether they answered the questions on your show. But actually the last 18 months, you know, sitting down at 5 o'clock every day and watching the press conferences with senior ministers, taking questions at press conferences and not answering them, the entire country was doing that. So do you think that this has had a sort of a more severe impact on the public's impression of politicians because politics of the last 18 months has been a matter of life and death, and they've been really engaged in what ministers and the Prime Minister has been saying in a way that in normal times perhaps they haven't been?
I think that's absolutely right, Matt, and I think everybody wants to know exactly what's going on in terms of vaccine efficacy or the epidemiological effects of this or that. And ministers, as you say, who don't answer the questions absolutely infuriate the public. I'll say something kind of unusual and controversial. Matt Hancock, came onto my show probably more often than any other minister. I'm sure there was dodges and weaves and evasions and so forth, but he basically tried to answer the hard questions and basically tried to come in every Sunday with something to say that was relevant to people watching. And we had a very, very strange experience. I don't know if you've had the same on Times Radio, but we had on the Sunday show, very strange experience, where at the beginning of the epidemic, my editor was saying, you know, we really ought to get some of the scientists themselves on. We really ought to get the Pfizer, Moderna people on to explain how their RNA vaccine works. And we need to get the latest from the epidemiologists advising the government. And I was saying, do you think people are going to sit there for sort of 20 minutes and listen? And the numbers went up and up and up. And I think 9 of the 10 most popular programs I've ever done since 2005 were during the pandemic, not because I was particularly interesting, not, dare I say it, because the politicians were particularly interesting, but because people were tuning in to hear scientists answering as accurately and honestly as they could important questions. Who'd have thunk it?
And how have you had to sort of change your style? I haven't done it for so long. And, you know, so Tony Blair was Prime Minister when you started doing the Sunday morning show. Do you try to show? I mean, I suppose it's difficult for you to say, well, you've not answered that question, but we'll move on. I mean, how far can you go in changing the way that you're approaching the interview to make clear that duff answers aren't the fault of you asking duff questions?
No, they are sometimes, of course. But yeah, what I try to do is if I ask a serious and important question and it's just evaded or avoided, I will try and stop the politician and say, look, that wasn't the question I asked. The question I asked you was this. And if they do it again, then I might a third time say, well, that wasn't the question I asked. I asked a really specific question and it's an important question for this reason. You know, but people will have noticed you refuse to answer it. And they look a bit cross, and then you move on. I don't think there's any point in doing it 12 or 13 times if you can avoid it, because the audience just starts to get irritated beyond belief and eventually switch off. You say you haven't answered this. This was really important. You should have answered it. And then you move on. And they take a political hit for that, I think.
Yeah, we all need to remember that journalists are only slightly less despised than politicians sometimes. So, you know, we need to be careful about how much to do that stuff. And how difficult is for you? The BBC is under a huge amount of political pressure. There's been, you know, big rows this week about whether or not the journalist Jess Brammer should join as the head of news. Emily Maitlis yesterday, your colleague, Newsnight presenter, say she looked like she was accusing the BBC of caving into pressure from Downing Street after she was told off for opening Newsnight with a monologue about Dominic Cummings breaking the rules. Are you worried about BBC impartiality? How easy is it to be a political journalist on the BBC right now?
It's really, really hard, I think. I remind myself before every show starts, in sort of 5 minutes before we're on air, that the people watching are passionate UKIP voting Brexiteers, are hard left supporters of Jeremy Corbyn, are everything in between, and they've all paid their license fees, or most of them have, and they all deserve, as it were, to think that the programme is a decent, fair treatment for everybody. But it's really difficult because, as you know, Matt, the country has become so angry and so divided. Everybody seems to be shouting at everybody else. Lots of us have retreated into political tribes and are engaged in kind of warfare from the trenches. And to be the neutral platform on which you can have a kind of civilized discussion, conversation across the divide becomes increasingly difficult.
And so, I mean, you've got politicians who won't answer the question. You're getting grief from Downing Street. You get grief from the BBC. How long will you keep doing the Andrew Marr show, do you think?
Well, probably as long as they will have me. But that may not be for very long. I just don't know. I've signed another contract for a couple of years. And I'm still enjoying it, despite everything. And our numbers are still very good. So if they do it by the numbers, they'll keep going. But who knows? I'm very aware I've been doing the job a long time. I don't think anyone's had their own show for as long as I have. I think it's 16 years now. And, you know, we're all journalistically mortal, like politically mortal. So I just don't know.
The one good thing about being a political journalist is you do tend to last longer than the people you're writing about, which is always a good reminder when you see people like Dominic Cummings and that sort of thing. What did you make of that Dominic Cummings interview this week?
I thought it was brilliantly handled by Laura. I thought she was, as it were, sympathetic enough to draw out from him the most interesting and extreme things he could say. And she did push back properly about, you were responsible for this. You know, there was a moment where she said, can you hear what you're saying at this stage? So it was a great scoop on her behalf. And it's really interesting. He has moved from being, as it were, the ultimate hate figure for Remainers and anti-Boris Johnson Conservatives and all the rest of it, to, as it were, their pin-up star. Because what he says about...
That was amazing.
I can't remember ever. Every prime minister suffers from leaks and criticism the whole time. But I can't remember ever anybody who was so close to the centre of things as Dominic Cummings, giving such a withering and closely detailed and backed up analysis of what went wrong so soon afterwards. And I think this is unique in British politics, and I'm gripped by it, as I think you are and almost everybody watching politics is.
Yeah, when you think that the people who worked around, people who are very close to Margaret Thatcher, very close to Tony Blair, you know, your Alistair Campbells, they're still loyally defending them to this day, never mind, you know, going after them after a couple of weeks. Andrew, I want to talk to you about The Elizabethans, your book, because I think it's really fascinating, and so many people in it have done even more to try to establish their place in history in recent weeks. Andrew, your new book, which is out in paperback now, Elizabethans, A History of How Modern Britain Was Forged, it's about the people who are around us right now. It's the sort of first draft of the sort
it
of...
It really is. It's the change. Yeah.
And so who, I mean, it's there's something for everyone in there. You know, it's Marcus Rashford to Meghan Markle to even some of the medical staff, you know, right up today with the medical staff who dealt with COVID. How do you go about picking all of those people?
So I was thinking, what are the big, as it were, social and mental changes? This starts, I wanted to write about Britain during the Queen's reign, because it's 70 years or so, which is, you know, the traditional 60 years and 10 of a human life. And it means that most people reading the book will remember quite a lot of what's happened in the book. And I was thinking that if you took a bunch of us today, if you kind of assembled 30 or 40 random people from outside your offices on the London South Bank, and you teletransported them back to 1953, obviously they would look very different to the people who were there at the beginning of the Queen's reign in terms of their clothes. Did they have moustaches? Did they flaunt tattoos? How fat were they? All those kind of things. And obviously we're also surrounded by totally different technologies, from, you know, our iPhones to our swollen vehicles to our car, all that stuff. But I thought the biggest changes of all are the mental changes. What we think about gender, race, sexuality, empire, authority, work, that's the really big revolution that's changed. Therefore, who were the people who brought about those changes in our thinking and the way we see the world? And that can be technologists and business people and scientists, but it's also social change makers. It's everyone, you know, as it were, from Jan Morris, which is a transgender story coming from The Times, which starts the book, because on Coronation Day, you would think that was the only story in town. Young new queen is crowned. But in fact, The Times has the scoop of the conquest of Everest. And it's got the scoop because of an incredibly intrepid, daring, dashing young ex-military foreign correspondent called James Morris. And he works out this very clever system to get the scoop back to London from the top of Everest without any of the Times' rivals, nationally or internationally, finding out what was going on. And James Morris, not that long afterwards, starts the journey to become Jan Morris, because from a very, very early age, James Morris was sure that he had been born in the wrong body and ought to have been a woman. And he goes through awful, very, very dramatic surgery in Casablanca and takes some what were at the time very dangerous drugs to transition to being woman, to becoming Jan Morris. And as Jan Morris, of course, becomes an incredibly loved and famous and successful and brilliant writer. And I thought it was really interesting just to start the story with something which feels very, very 2021, which is a trans story. And so that in a way was the model. And all the way through, I was trying to find people from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, who made our intellectual furniture, our landscape internally, what it is today. And therefore I was looking for different fields. There's a lot about sexuality in the book, but there's also an awful lot about how we work and trade unions and politics too.
And I think the focus on the like the non-politician, you know, people, it's not about the politics necessarily. Well, it's politics with a small p. It's not about Westminster ups and downs and ins and outs and that sort of thing, but about those people who are having an impact on our society from different fields, whether it's sport or music and that sort of thing. And I thought that I hadn't really thought about it, because I remember, because it was only last year, wasn't it, that Jan Morris died, and obviously I sort of revisited that story then. But to use that as the start of your book, you're right, it does feel like this is a live conversation we're having right now in 2021, and yet the story began when the Queen first took the throne. Who do you think, if you had to pick one person, and I suppose this is a really difficult thing, if you are transported back 70-odd years to the South Bank to meet the Andrew Marr of the day, who's the one person who you would say is going to, you really need to focus on? The ultimate Elizabethan.
The ultimate Elizabethan. That is really difficult. I'm going to take a slightly strange answer, I think, and pick out Anita Roddick. So Anita Roddick is sort of a Jewish-Italian immigrant by background and origin, and she is the person who founds the Body Shop. And I would pick her because, A, she reminds us how much we owe to people who have come here relatively recently and not understood the rules and therefore done things differently. But also, if you look around and think how ubiquitous and everywhere is the sort of connection between business and modern ethics, environmentalism, not being cruel to animals, treating your workers decently, even if they're in China, all of that. All businesses endlessly talk about their ethical investments, and it's all around us. And this all starts from one woman who is struggling to survive after her husband has gone on a long sort of journey to discover himself, riding a horse across South America, and she has got very little money and very little to do. And so she starts this shop selling beauty treatments out of reusable containers in a tiny little street in the back streets of Brighton. And it grows to become a global empire. But more important than that, I think she changes the way that so many businesses conduct themselves. This idea that a business ought to be in some sense ethical is so all around us now that we take it for granted. But it starts with her, and it starts in a particular place in the back streets of Brighton. So that, you know, that's perhaps an unusual example. But I think she's a very, very good case of somebody who never did normal politics, but put ethical treatment of animals, proper treatment of the people making the product all around the world, environmental concerns, etc., absolutely at the heart of her business. And that's how most of us, one way or another, still think today.
And actually, I suppose that trend has gone from just being sort of businesses to now stars, famous people, celebrities. You know, Bob Geldof is more famous for his... you know, there's no disrespect to the Boomtown Rats, but more famous for his work with Live Aid and that sort of thing than necessarily for the music. David Attenborough too, you know, accomplished TV presenter, but, you know, it's his campaigning on climate change. And again, most recently, Marcus Rashford. Probably if you went back to your people 70 years ago on the South Bank, they wouldn't expect their footballers to be, you know, social campaigners in the same way. Do you think that's been part of the shift too, that we expect... as well as businesses become more ethical and, you know, recognise their social impact, actually the same is true now of celebrities, as we would have called them.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, you mentioned Bob Geldof there. And what I say in the book is that he's kind of laughed at and sneered at quite a lot. I mean, Private Eye called him Saint Bob all the way through. But actually, if you look at the number of people whose lives he saved by what he did with Live Aid, you know, he is quite close to Saint Bob. And I think it's very important in a book like this to include, alongside the many villains, kind of heroes who have made a big change. And he would be a good and very unlikely kind of foul-mouthed Dublin example.
Yeah, and I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? That in the past, you know, the first Elizabethan age and other historical figures, it's tended to have been lots of people, for, you know, the people who get written about and remembered are all from a very similar sort of social strata, if you like. And actually, it's such an amazing collection that you've put together, which covers, you know, people from far more backgrounds, races, geography, and all of that.
Yeah, it's you have to be very careful that it doesn't just become one mini biography after another. So I've tried to cluster it together with themes and also look at the big sort of some of the big successes and failures. The underlying argument is that after the war, when Churchill was still there as the Queen's first Prime Minister, he was warning about huge opportunities and huge dangers in the sort of century or so ahead. And by and large, the British had two big projects, I think, for roughly the centre and right. It was to find an alternative big, big global role that replaced the Commonwealth. So we were still a really, really important country around the world. And I think in all the European agonies and the various wars we fought, we failed to do that. And on the left, the big project was to create the world's most generous and successful welfare society, as it were. And by and large, after what happened in the 70s and the winter of discontent, that's failed as well. And I think the reason that both eventually failed is that we didn't actually earn enough as a country in our economy to give ourselves the kind of power and the lifestyle that we thought we deserved. So in a sense, it's a slightly downbeat story. But in that, there are lots and lots of examples of people making things for the better, inventing extraordinary devices that change the world. You know, the British contribution to computing is extraordinary. And you've got everything from, you know, the jet engine to the hovercraft to British breakthroughs in science and medicine and maths. You've got all the huge cultural effect of everyone from Dusty Springfield to the Beatles. So there's a lot to cheer about in these books. And I was very concerned not to produce a kind of slightly doleful, pessimistic litany of everything getting worse. I'm, by and large, a chirpy, glass half full kind of person.
And it's, well, we need that in the world right now. Andrew, it's been lovely to speak to you. Thank you so much for joining us on Times Radio.
Matt, it's been a delight. Thank you very much indeed.
Andrew Marr there. And Elizabethans, A History of How Modern Britain Was Forged is out now in paperback if you want a sort of glass half full approach to what's going on in the world right now. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. We bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts from.